Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be discussing a subject that so many of us shy away from. Even if we have an abundance of money, the topics of wills, trusts, probates, well, sort of gives us the willies. It shouldn't. We need to be able to look at these subject matters with eyes wide open and with understanding that this can affect those people that survive us as we leave this earth with whatever assets we might have. If you don't have any, you might not be interested. But if you do have assets and you want them to be passed along to certain individuals, or you want monies to be handled in a particular way, by golly, you've got to be informed, because sometimes wills can read one way, trusts another, and probate, holy Moses, that can go into a direction you would never anticipate. Our guest today is John Farr. John has co-authored a book with Suzanne Bayer. It's called The Inventor's Fortune Up for Grabs. Now, for those of you that are regular listeners, you will be familiar with the title because we had Suzanne on about a month ago. But there were so many questions that Suzanne could not answer that I had brought to her in the programming. And she said, Donna, you need to talk to John. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do today. I want to welcome John Farr to the airwaves. Thank you so much for being with us today, John.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Donna.
It's a joy. John, I was so impressed with not only the litigation that you went through with Suzanne and her family regarding this legacy of, I can't say it was an immense fortune, it wasn't, but it was something that really brought forth a lot of questions that none of the family had even had an idea, the survivors, that they would have to explore. Give us a little bit of background. I know you're a Rhode Island attorney. You really worked with great nieces and great nephews of Art Hadley, and you challenged a lot of, shall we say, foregone conclusions that had been made by certain parties. Tell us a little bit about this and how you got involved.
Well, Art Hadley was an immigrant from South Africa when he was about three in the 1880s. And he was a very bright, technically oriented individual, went to the technical high school in Providence, and entered the jewelry industry in Providence at the time. Was the capital of that industry. Very soon, he formed his own company called the Hadley Jewelry Company. And in 1913, he invented what we know today as the expansion bracelet. Now, by the expansion bracelet, what most people are familiar with is the wristwatch expansion bracelet, which is what his invention eventually turned into. But what he invented initially was a very fine woman's bracelet that could slide over the wrist, was expandable. Out of that, he created, which for the time was a large fortune, and he died in 1941, leaving several million dollars in trust for his wife, and after her death, continuing on in trust for their two children. And then at the death of the second child, the trust was to be distributed to the grandchildren. The problem was that his estate planning documents and attorney failed to anticipate what would happen if both of the children died without lineal heirs. And as a result of that gap, it created about 33 different individuals who had potential claims to the fortune in the trust. And my clients, you know, Suzanne and her brother and cousins, were among those 33. They were the only blood relatives of Art Hadley. And you would think that that would give them a higher level of standing, but in fact, it offers them very little protection at all. And the powers that be in Providence had basically written them off as having no chance whatsoever to win, and that's what you're referring to when you say I challenged some of the foregone conclusions and eventually developed a whole new theory of the case, which brought them very much into the case, and they ended up as a group splitting almost $2 million.
We have in this situation a trust that had been established. I have known clients throughout the years where their spouse has left a trust, or not unlike what you have here, that there were children that were left trusts, they died, and then there were the nieces and nephews and so on and so forth. So many times when trusts are set up, they are set up with good intentions, but the laws may change. Certain individuals may not survive, like this case here. You have situations that are going to be brought into court. I have known people that ended up losing their cases, and the attorneys made all the money, and they ended up with, like, you know, $8 million case that I know of, and the attorneys ended up with almost all the money, and the people were lucky if they got $100,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other side, where a person hasn't left a will, and then you have to go into probate. Let's cover some of these topics, because a will is one thing, a trust is something else, and the probate process is something else, and every state is different. Am I correct?
That's very correct. I wouldn't overemphasize the difference between the probate courts in the various states, because while the language is different and the procedure is different, the concept is pretty much the same from state to state. But what many people think of when they talk about the differences between state is every state has a statute that establishes a pecking order for who will inherit if the deceased person has died without a will, or in our case, died without inadequate instructions. And those statutes, the pecking order, if you will, does vary quite a bit from state to state. It's what each state legislature thinks in their infinite wisdom, what the deceased person would have intended if he'd gotten around to writing something.
Mm-hmm. And how in the world are you going to be able to judge that, for heaven's sakes? I mean,
you can't.
No,
it's hugely arbitrary.
Yeah, and that is really partially what ended up being to your advantage in the particular case that the book, The Inventor's Fortune Up for Grabs, is all about. Let's go into wills. I was talking with someone just about a week ago who said a member of their family had passed away. There was no will,
mm-hmm.
but the surviving members, in this case, fortunately, were pretty compatible. They
mm-hmm.
said, we know how we'll handle it, and they're not at each other's throats, which is not the case all too frequently. And this person, fortunately, did not have that large of an estate. However, a will is vitally important. Why do you think a person has such a difficulty in writing a will? And what makes a will really legal? Because I know that there are some wills that are made that are challenged, that people say, I'm sorry, but this isn't legal.
Yeah. Well, you've asked several questions there. Let me take them kind of in order of importance. First of all, a lot of people don't write a will I mean, there's probably millions of reasons. You know, inadvertence, ignorance, just didn't get around to it, afraid to confront their own mortality. But when you die without a will, you just use the example of your friends and said, fortunately, they were compatible, and so there wasn't a lot of arguing. Well, when somebody dies without a will, there's nothing to argue about, really, because the state statute takes over and runs the whole show. The probate court merely oversees the process, but the person put in charge has virtually no authority to make decisions on their own. They basically have to come into court and ask permission for everything they do. So if you've got a relatively small estate and you're subjected to that process, in all likely, your family is going to be subject to a cost that percentage-wise is a much larger percentage of their estate than had they done it a more proper and formal way. So the smaller estates actually get hit worse than the larger estates, not in terms of dollars, but in terms of percentage of the estate. The let me just stop at that point and go to your next question.
My next question also would be, when someone is writing up a will, and if they want to appoint an executor to their estate, time goes on and maybe things change. They don't. What should someone consider when appointing an executor? Sometimes people say, well, I'll do my attorney, or well, I'll do a bank, which I don't think is a good idea. How do you suggest someone determine who should handle their estate?
Well, it largely, you know, to pick the right person largely depends on the facts and circumstances of that particular estate. For instance, if you had a major business, say a 51% ownership in a publicly traded company, and other assets of that sophistication, you very well might want a bank or somebody with a lot of financial savvy to be able to lead that estate through all of the various minefields. We personally believe, and this is just a personal belief, but we believe that it's really a conflict of interest for the attorney drafting the documents to also serve in those fiduciary capacities.
I agree.
Like an executor. So we don't do that. But, you know, it should not be an emotional choice. It shouldn't be based on, you know, I love my Aunt Sarah, so I'm going to name her the executrix. You're going to want to be much more pragmatic than that and select somebody who has at least the same degree of judgment and discernment that you yourself have. Because really the executor, or the female version of that executrix, is the one who's really stepping into your shoes and taking over. Now, you're dead, so obviously you can't manage your affairs anymore. So this person is taking over. So a person doesn't have to be a financial genius or have any other requisite skills and knowledge if they have the good judgment to go out and find somebody who can bring that kind of expertise to bear. So a good executor would be somebody, if there's a lot of financial assets involved, somebody who is good at interviewing and selecting a good financial advisor to advise that executor how to go through. So really wisdom and competence, not necessarily specific, you know, skills, are very, very important. Obviously, you want somebody who's trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
If they're children involved, especially young children, you've got somebody who ought to have a heart, you know, and a soul, who's going to look at this thing from a human standpoint rather than just from, you know, following the black letter law. So those are just a few of the examples that lead me to say, yeah, you really need to look at the facts and circumstances of the case and then match that up. Now, you can also have co-executors. So that's the way we sometimes create sort of a check and balance system in administering the estate.
I think that is a very good idea. That brings to mind a particular situation that I recall really had a tremendous impact on a woman who inherited a substantial fortune and was supposed to have been entitled to this. Her husband, who was like about 20 years older than her, and they'd been married for a number of years, he put it into a trust. And the story was really tragic because there was an attorney that handled the trust, that had handled all this man's business, and he had not informed his wife at all about what he was doing. And this attorney in the trust, because the husband said, well, she's, you know, she is not that good at managing money, and I handle this, that, or the other. This poor woman was only going to be getting like $300 a month, and there's no way she could live on it. And the attorney, because of the way the laws, this was in the state of California, because of the way that it was drawn up, the trust, and with the attorney handling it, she could not have access to any of the money, and the attorney was getting a phenomenal fee every year that was locked into this trust, and he would not change or make any adjustment. This woman was reduced to not quite a poverty level, but very close to it, and she was told she had no legal recourse by other people that she had gone to, and it was quite a tragedy. When people set up trusts, many times they will have attitudes about those trusts, and gee whiz, so-and-so is not very good with money, they have these different judgments, and they may or may not be correct. But once they're gone, can those trusts be changed? I mean, or are they locked into perpetuity as they have been written?
Well, I've got a good legal answer, and that depends.
I love it. Okay.
First of all, Donna, you know, there are many, many different kinds of trust. And one thing I would like, a point I would like your listeners to take home is that there is no such thing as a trust. And let me explain that. The public's perception as to wills and trusts and whatnot is that one is pretty much the same as another. And that's what I mean, that there's no such thing as a trust. You can't walk into a library and pull out a form book of a trust. Each trust should be, you know, individually customized for the goals and objectives of the person that they're doing the trust for. So, for example, in my trust, or our firm's trust, we always give the beneficiary redress for a improperly performing trustee, or just a, you know, trustee who's not performing very well. He's trying as hard as he can, and, you know, working to his ability, but he just was a poor selection.
Right.
So we always give a way out of that. But the way you give that exit is going to vary depending on what the goals of the trust are. If you've got a child who's a drug addict, you don't want to give that child a right to remove a trustee who's going to say no to them. I'm not giving you money to go buy drugs. So in a situation like that, we'd work with the, our term for of a settlor of a trust is a trust maker. know, the person who made the trust. So we would work with our trust maker and suggest different alternatives of placing that discretion, that power, with somebody that the trust maker trusts rather than vest it with the child themselves. Or you've got your, you know, your perfect child or perfect children, you know, which every family has, we know, and you just give them the right. So it's got to be tailored. And another thing we do, you know, most legal documents in this area are very, very technical. And they limit themselves to the subjects that need to be handled technically. Our trust, by example, you know, we give our clients a tremendous opportunity, and they take advantage of it, to just express themselves in non-legal terms about what it is they want to accomplish. And, you know, take investments. Do they want the trustee to be very conservative? Which means investing in bonds, or do they want their trustee to have a great deal of discretion and you know, invest in common stocks exclusively, or do they want some hybrid in between, or do they want to make their trustee only use a certain advisor? These trusts properly done should be highly individualized. And unfortunately, in our profession, generally in the United States, you don't see that. There's this very small group of attorneys who are really doing this, you know, the right way. And just one comment, and I'd be happy to do this later, but you've talked about wills and you've talked about trust, but I would like to accomplish, before we end today, where those two instruments, those two strategies, if you will, fit in, and when do you use one and when do you use another, or do you use a hybrid of it?
Oh, now that is excellent. I'd love for you to cover that, because that was going to be my next question to you.
Okay. I read your mind.
Oh, yes, you did. I love it. That's cool. All right. So let's go for it.
Okay. Well, first of all, if your only estate planning document is a will, that generally forces you into probate. And in, you know, my 40 years of experience, probate is very, very rarely needed to accomplish what the family wants to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So by basing your estate planning on a will, you end up forcing the family to go through, it's usually a minimum of about a year, sometimes longer than that, frequently longer than that. It's an expensive process, and it's public, and it's all avoidable.
Oh, that's interesting.
But not if you rely on a will. Now, some people try to get around that by putting everything in joint tenancy. So let's take a non-married couple first. So there's a mother, and she puts all her property in joint tenancy with her daughter. Well, that brings up a whole bunch of problems. First of all, she's made a taxable gift to the daughter right away. And the IRS will ultimately probably pick up on that. A needlessly taxable gift. So potentially taxes are going to the government that need not have been paid. Second of all, in a situation like that, the daughter gets into creditor problems, gets sued, there's an execution on it, and suddenly at least half of the mother's house, for example, potentially all of the house, goes to satisfy daughter's creditors. If people die in the wrong sequence, that house can go to the wrong person. For example, the mother dies, the daughter is a joint tenant, and she then dies, and it doesn't get shared with her siblings, which is probably what her mother intended, but instead might go to the daughter's husband or the daughter's children. So it ends up going in a place that mother never would have intended. So that's one of the ways people use to avoid, you know, avoid probate, and that I would say close to 50% of the time backfires and ends up, you know, the wrong thing. So, and there are other devices that are used to avoid probate. Probate happens to be a very lucrative area of the law. And in some situations, you know, in large firms frequently, they'll have a whole trust department administering wills. So the, you know, my profession has very little incentive to learn about ways to avoid that particular practice, and they either, you know, improperly or in good conscience say, and I just heard it yesterday at a seminar I was at where somebody asked this question, and the lawyer said, oh, probate in Connecticut is no big deal. And it's almost word for word that phrase. They're not thinking at that time about the legal fees that they're going to charge, you know, which are on top of the regular administrative fees of going through the process. So in my opinion, the best way to, you know, if it's a proper situation for avoiding probate, the best way to do it is not base your estate planning on a will, but base it on a revocable living trust. And I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about that. But there's an aspect of that that gets very, very little publicity, and that's the revocable living trust only really accomplishes objective if all of the person's property is titled consistent with utilizing that trust. So, for instance, I just got a will last week where there's a page and a half about how his residence, the husband and wife were widow and widower, and they both had children from their first marriage. Mm-hmm. And this man had only a will. He had a page and a half of how that house was to be managed for the benefit of his children from his first marriage. The only problem is, when I looked in the land records, the house was titled jointly with rights of survivorship between the two of them. So that will could have been 50 pages dealing with the house, and it would have had no effect whatsoever on the disposition of the house. The house went to the wife with no strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
So lawyers, by and large, view themselves as draftspeople. Their job is to draft the very, very best document they can, and they generally do. There's generally very, very good documents, but they don't see themselves as being responsible for making sure that the titling of assets is in alignment with the documents that they drafted. So the client walks out thinking they've done everything they can, their estate planning is in good shape, only to find out when the first person dies that it blows up.
That explains to me, and I'm just going through my own memory files, why someone that I knew ended up losing all of their property that they had been willed by their father.
Right.
And they were the one of two surviving siblings, had been made the executor of the estate, and because there was a third marriage, and there was something else, it was a very, very involved case, but in my mind, I thought these people, that weren't even related to this man, were mm-hmm. not even blood relatives, should never have been entitled.
Right.
And yet, what you're saying is that dependent on state laws relative to properties, you could have something, if someone is not attentive to that particular detail, that would create a mountain of hassles.
Yeah, we see it all the time, Donna.
Oh my goodness.
That's what our firm calls the unintended heir.
All right, I'm going to ask you, would you stay with me for a few minutes longer?
Certainly.
Wonderful. This is Donna Sebo. My guest today is John Farr. We're talking about something that you need to pay attention to, and that's wills, trusts, and probates. Now, I know this is something that maybe you just don't give too much attention to, but believe me, I have seen some bad things happen to good people and just nightmares of situations. Listen up, because we've got some more coming. John's going to stay with us a little bit longer. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna, and we're talking about wills, trusts, and probates. John Farr is my guest. He was very much involved in a very complicated case that was worth millions of dollars to the heirs. The book that you can read, if you're interested in doing so, it's called The Inventor's Fortune Up for Grabs, Suzanne Bayer and John Farr, who was the attorney that represented the family members. This is a case that's worth reading about, but because of this book, and I had interviewed Susan about a month ago, I wanted to have John on because I really liked the way he presented legal information in the book. And of course, for those of you that have been listening, you're aware of the things that he said, and it's so important for us to be educated regarding this. So, John, I want to thank you for staying some extra time with us. One of the things I wanted to address, when people are, let's say, getting older. Maybe they've had their will and they've done this. Our world is very different today. You might have, let's say, a family, a husband and wife, and maybe they've got 2 to 4 kids, and they have really done a good job with managing. They have some property assets. They've got stocks and bonds. They're setting up a trust. They're getting older. And maybe one of those parents may end up needing to have some medical care.
Right.
And a trust has been set up for property. How do people that are getting older, and I want to also do a case with a real younger family, but let's take the older scenario, because we have so many people that are living to be close to 100, if not over 100 years of age. They may have assets that are substantial, and they go, oh my goodness, what if one of us becomes sick? What can we do?
Mm-hmm.
If they need medical care, and I have a very special family that we've known for years, and the father died about 10 years ago. The mother just passed away at the age of 96. Now, fortunately, she had two daughters who are just really okay with each other. They're not at each other's throats, and there's a substantial legacy that was left. But the daughter was able, when she was given the power of attorney, because her mother needed special care, she was able to go in and utilize the money. Her most important concern was that her mother have a quality of life until she died, which she did. She had access to money. But sometimes people have things set up where if they need extended care like this, they can't get to it. A spouse dies, they've got a trust, they can't access it. What would you suggest in today's world, right here and right now, if someone is looking or listening to this show, and they're mature, and they've got assets, and they've got kids, and they go, wow, what if I end up being in my 90s and needing medical care? How could we tap into that? What would you recommend for that?
Well, the least desirable situation is to fall into what we have in this country as, you know, as a safety net, and that's Medicaid. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in the media today about, you know, abolishing Medicaid. But right now, Medicaid's the system that the government has in place to take care of medical care if somebody has really run out of assets.
Mm-hmm.
So most people would not want to be in the situation of running out of assets and falling into that safety net. It's not a great situation. So one of the best products out there that I happen to be a believer in, I don't sell it myself, but I refer a lot of clients to people who do, and that's long-term care insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're insurable at all, which is, you know, becomes a question after you get into your 70s, so you frequently are not insurable. But that, you know, that is just an excellent product, and it's a very variable product in the sense that you don't have to purchase, and generally don't need a Cadillac long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many variables that you can work with a good, knowledgeable agent to tailor that policy to cover the most, you know, pressing needs and thereby keep the premiums down to affordable levels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a product, the earlier you are when you get it, the less expensive the premiums are going to be. But, you know, my wife and I bought our policy when we were about 61, and I was pleasantly surprised that the premium was as low as it is. So I think it's really a great product. And now many of the states are giving incentives to people to buy these policies because it ultimately keeps them off the public rolls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they run out of money. If you can't provide for that, then, you know, hopefully at a fairly early age, you start saving for that possibility so that you have those assets in hand that are going to be sufficient to see you through the sickness. A lot of people, everyone against my advice, has given away their assets to their children. And you've generally got to wait 5 years after you give those assets away to be eligible for Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
But that does throw you into Medicaid. And second of all, children are not always nice to their parents.
Right.
And I've just seen one tragedy, after another. It wasn't for Medicaid purposes, but a woman in my community, I didn't represent her at the time, but she came to me afterwards. But to avoid probate, she put her house jointly with herself and her two children. And then about 5 years later, she met a really nice man from Illinois. She was in Rhode Island. Met a very nice man from Illinois, moved out there and got married, and asked her children to deed the house back to her, and they wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they got all kinds of good reasons. I mean, it's like political spin. You can make anything sound reasonable by what you put on it. So, again, it comes around to planning, and planning thoughtfully, and planning with a team of advisors, and I emphasize team, because in our planning, we always work directly with the client's various advisors, their CPA and their financial planner and whoever else are important advisors to them. And all of that team signs on to the plan. So you don't just get the legal perspective. You get the financial perspective. You get the tax, perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And in our opinion, it's malpractice not to practice, that way. There's another thing, it's a little bit off subject, but it's another huge misunderstanding in the public, or not so much a misunderstanding, but something they don't think about. We think about we're alive and well today, and then we think someday we're going to die. But there's an in-between that happens to a large percentage of people before they die, and that's that they become incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
And if all you have is a will has no validity, it has no effect until after you die. Whereas a properly drafted trust can take over, it's created during your lifetime. If you do it right, you put the property into the trust during lifetime or set it up as a beneficiary of disability policies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in place when that incapacity arises. So you mentioned, again, you've got a lot of friends who have estate planning problems, but you mentioned the case where the daughter had a power of attorney,
mm-hmm.
and problems resulted out of that. Well, a power of attorney is just that. There's no accountability tied to a power of attorney. So if your agent goes out and does something, that the rest of the family thinks is improper, it's very, very difficult and very expensive to go after the holder of the power of attorney. A trust, one way I describe to my clients what a revocable trust is it's a power of attorney with accountability and instructions.
Interesting.
So, instead of being a 5-page power of attorney, it's a much lengthier document because it directs, the trustee has the power that the trust maker gives to them, but they also have an absolute obligation to follow all of the trust maker's instructions. So if, for example, take a mother who creates a trust and names the daughter as the trustee and says, I want you to take care of grandma so long as she lives, the daughter has to follow those instructions. Whereas if the daughter had a power of attorney and mom said to her early, now I want you to use this to take care of grandma, there's absolutely nothing that requires the holder of the power of attorney to do that. So there's a huge difference between, planning with powers of attorney and planning with a well-drafted trust.
Well, John, I'm telling you, we are out of time. This information, I think, is extremely good. You have just given us so much wonderful, wonderful detail. And I know when it comes to law, there's a lot of nuances, and every state is different in certain applications that have to be considered, and one does need to have an awareness of being, in a way, open enough to explore finding someone that would be accountable. Now, I would like for my listeners, I know we're just about out of time here, to be aware of the book again, The Inventor's Fortune, Up for Grabs. John Farr is one of the authors. Suzanne Baer, who is one of the people involved in the legal action, one of the members of family involved with John. They were a team. And you can go to theinventorsfortune.com. If you'd like to find out more information about law and about John Farr, go to P, like Paul, dash R, like Robert, law.com. That's P, like Paul, dash R, like Robert, law.com. And you can explore more of this information. The saying, ignorance is no excuse, in any time frame really holds true. And in our world today, with all of the changes regarding taxes, legalities of this one type or another, as he said, it's important to have a good team. And whether you have a small estate or whether you have something that is substantial, remember, if you want certain things to be done in a certain way, if you want to gift something, find out the best way to do it. Check it out. Don't forget the book, The Inventor's Fortune, Up for Grabs. Also, check out his website, John Farr, P-F-A-R-R, and his website, p-rlaw.com. John Farr, thank you so much for being with me today. This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you, Donna.
Oh, you're welcome, John.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95, plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to give me a buzz and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, I would be delighted to do so. I wanted to let you know about the guests that are going to be coming up next week. Again, 888-815-9756 is the telephone number to call into, 888-815-9756. On Monday, we're going to be talking with Sherry Matthews about some situations and institutions in Waco, Texas. The publication is titled, We Are Not Orphans. This is a fascinating picture into a reality that existed and actually exists today, but we're going to step back a little bit in time, and I think you'll find it interesting. And then The Common Touch by Madison Harper is very important. This philosophy, I think, is very uplifting. And then Carolyn Wentz, who is a woman that books, speakers, cruises, has a fascinating life. I've had a chance to meet her in person. And since we're getting close to Mother's Day, I thought it was appropriate. She wrote a book saying a mother is a mother unless she's earth vomit. Now, that sounds really wild and crazy, but she talks about dealing with adolescence, and Carolyn just has a wonderful sense of humor. Then we're going to be talking about dancing with midwives and FASEN, This is about women dealing with childbirth, et cetera. And again, we're sort of paying a tribute to women and Mother's Day, which comes up on the 9th of May. And then Harper's Rules, Danny Cahill, is going to be giving us some insights and information about how to be more successful as individuals. Now, the listing for all of the guests for the month of May will be posted by this weekend, by the 1st, and I also will have my newsletter out, so you'll be able, if you're on the newsletter, receivership end, you will be able to get a copy of that newsletter, find out what's coming up on the Donna Sebo Show. Also, you can check in on the BBS site, and when you check in to the show, you can always go into show information. There's a little button there, and you just tap on that, and you'll get a listing of all the people that are coming up. And if you want to talk to me, 888-815-9756. For those of you up in the far north, in the state of Alaska, I'm going to be traveling up there as of May 9th, and I'll be in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. So I will be traveling in that wonderful state. I just love it. I just think Alaska is one of the places on the planet that just has an absolute magic to it. So if you're up in that area between the 9th and the 15th, I'm going to be available for private sessions with people, and you can call my office if you're interested at 800-872-8852 or 253-582-5604. People are inventive. Lots of times, people decide they're going to do something, not because they're going to become millionaires. Believe it or not, most people are not especially interested in becoming millionaires. They want to feel like their lives are productive, they have value, and they want to make a difference in the world. Well, there is a young man by the name of Gabriel Levinson. He absolutely loves books. I think he's just as passionate about books as I am. And he has what he calls Book Bike. Now, this is a giveaway library on wheels. And he's in Chicago. Now, in 2007, he decided he was going to hand out free books that he had gotten from various sources to anybody that might want to have a free book. So he rides around on his bike. He's loaded up with all these books. And people loved it. Absolutely loved it. He said he wanted to get books right in front of people as they're walking down the street. And he said, gee whiz, maybe there'll be some intelligent conversation between people. That is what reading and opening yourself up to different environments of subject matter can do for you. You can be an extremely interesting person to other people because you have some awareness of different subject matters. Well, after he had started this service in 2007, he built an outsized tricycle that could carry 200 pounds of books. This is what he did. Being in Chicago, he found out about publishers there and said, do you have any books you just want to get rid of? I'm just going to pass them out. So they had books they needed to get rid of. He said whenever people were encountered by him, and he said, you want a free book? They'd sort of look at him a little bit fun. But he said, wow, the conversations that started up. In 2010, he gathered donations from fellow bibliophiles, raising $1,400, and that money he used to purchase volumes of material from local bookstores. And he said, people can choose whatever book they want from my bike, and they're inspired to go back to the bookstore and build their own personal library. Do you know that this year he wants to collect $10,000 worth of publications and hopes to give them all away? People are donating books to him because they have books in their library, and they say, gee whiz, this is a wonderful idea. So he said, this is something that he's very, very enthusiastic about. And he said, it is a wonderful way to be able to meet new people, talk about different subjects, and know that maybe you've touched their lives in a special way. And hopefully, they will want, as he mentioned earlier, to build their own library. Knowledge is power only when you can use it. But sometimes you have to start at a space where you read and you explore so that you begin to question. When you do that, then you're the one that may have an impact in changing laws working in the community, making a difference. Remember, when you are literate, you should learn how to think, to question, to search, to explore, to be curious, to be innovative. All of this and more is going to be within you only if you invest in yourself. I love television, but I'll tell you, there's a time and place for everything. And I know how much my world has expanded, and I hope yours has too. When you listen to the show and you hear all of the different authors that I have from so many different arenas of life, this show is very eclectic. But that's the purpose of it. That is how I wanted this show to be. I like to think it opens opportunities for new ideas and new concepts so that you realize that you do have the power. You're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Your life belongs to you, and you have the right and privilege to be able to choose how you want to live it. This is Donna Sebo. Have an absolutely awesome week, and wherever you are, remember that you are special, and I'm so glad you've been able to share this time with me. God bless. Have a great weekend. Talk to you on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.